Hi, it's Bob from Royal Spa. Soaking in a hot tub full of Epsom salts is the absolute best way to minimize everyday aches and pains. And we know all about Epsom salts at Royal Spa. Royal Spa hot tubs are the only hot tubs on the market that can safely and effectively use Epsom salts. Made right here in Indiana, Royal Spa hot tubs are the highest quality hot tubs on the market. Visit any one of our three Indianapolis locations or visit royalspa.com.
Ah, Royal Spa.
Dan Duggan, the Giants beat writer from The Athletic. And Dan, good to have you with us. Thanks for taking the time to chat with some folks in Indy.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Hey, after the great start to the season that you got, before we get into the selfish reasoning behind our conversation, after you guys got in off to the, 6-1 start to begin the season, how disappointing was it to end the way it ended? Or for those of you on the inside, did you kind of see it playing out the way it played out?
Yeah, no, I definitely wouldn't use the word disappointing. You're kind of waiting for the other shoe to drop. I mean, I don't think anyone looked at this as like a 13-14 win team. So when they were on that pace, it felt like regression would catch up to them at some point. And even Joe Shane, the GM, at the midpoint, we spoke about the bye, he wasn't getting too cocky, but I think he kind of sensed that it was coming. Obviously, it did. And then obviously, we end the season with the win at Minnesota. I mean, it ended very ugly in Philly. But getting a playoff win, that's the first playoff win since Super Bowl 46. You know, it's been a long time coming for this franchise. So, yeah, I mean, obviously it ended on a bad note, but I think overall this season was really encouraging, despite the, they kind of struggled down the stretch, but still, righted the ship enough to get in the playoffs and then win a playoff game. I think everyone kind of feels like the arrow's pointing up here, which it hasn't been that way for a long time.
And then the reaction to the game against the Eagles, I mean, the Giants weren't really in it. Granted, the Eagles are a phenomenal football team. Now, I don't see any real weaknesses there, but 38-7 had to be an incredible disappointment to not even be in the game. What did they see from a local standpoint? What was the biggest complaint of of the way that one ended?
Yeah, I mean, like I said, definitely a deflating end of the season. You know, as teams go on little playoff runs, you kind of, fans are going to say, hey, we can make a run. Again, I don't think they, I think they overachieved this year. I don't think anyone's really that upset. I mean, obviously the way it went down was ugly, but I mean, Philly's just a significantly better team. I mean, you look at their roster, I mean, 1-53, they're just so much better. And unfortunately for the Giants, it really showed up on the field because this coaching staff, I think, had done a great job all year of working around their weaknesses, finding little things they could exploit the opponents. They just couldn't do it against Philly. They were just outmanned, and Philly has a good coaching staff. So it all kind of was a perfect storm, and obviously the result was pretty ugly.
Hey, Dan, it's Brendan. I know the last time that you jumped on here on The Fan, we talked a lot about Daniel Jones and what he has done in a Giants uniform this year. But I guess looking at the entire campaign and now his relationship with Brian Daboll, that continues to grow. Has Daniel Jones done enough in the minds of the people around the building that he is legitimately the guy for long-term action under center in New York?
Yeah, he has. And, Joe Shane didn't even really play his card that close to the vest when he spoke yesterday. He's got a season-ending press conference. And he actually slipped at one point and said, Daniel's going to be here. But then he kind of tried to put that back a little bit and said, well, we're going to hopefully work something out. But, I mean, they're clearly operating under the impression that he'll be there. I mean, they have the franchise tag if they need to go that route. But he showed enough that they feel like that he is the guy that, I don't know, they're going to give him some crazy monster deal. But I think they probably see a future with him, give him a few years, in that $30 million-plus range, and they believe they can build this roster up around him and that he showed enough that he can be the guy. Obviously, led him to the playoffs this year, won a playoff game, and they think that there's still more to come if they build up a better roster around him.
Of course, from an Indianapolis perspective, we're most interested in the Giants because of the coach opening here. Mike Kafka, the Giants offensive coordinator, Wink Martindale, the Giants defensive coordinator, have both gone through interviews with the coach with the Colts. Let's take Kafka first off. Is he ready to be an NFL head coach in your opinion?
Yeah, I mean, obviously that's one of those questions that's hard to answer because I feel like, you never know until they get in that seat because it could turn out like Nathaniel Hackett, I will say, as far as a pedigree, it's tough to come from a better one. A guy who played kind of all over the league, so he saw a lot there as a backup quarterback. I think a lot of times backup quarterbacks, end up making pretty good coaches. But then, with Andy Reid was really in his formative years. Then he comes here with Brian Daboll, who obviously – I think he's pretty highly regarded offensive mind around the league, and they melded really well together. But he is still young. He hasn't been doing this for a terribly long time. This was his first year as a coordinator. So there would be a risk involved if you were to hand it over to him. It's not like he has this super long track record as being this top-notch coordinator. But, you know, as we know, so much more goes into that job anyways. So much of it's, personality-driven and how you manage everything that goes into being a head coach. So I don't think there's any way to know that for sure. But definitely, if you look around the trends in the league, there's been a real emphasis on finding these next up-and-coming young offensive minds, and he certainly belongs in that group based on what he's done to date.
Yeah, you mentioned personality, and I think that's huge for an NFL head coach or head coach at any stop in any sport. What is Kafka like on a personal level?
Well, I'll say this. Someone from a different outlet wrote a feature on him recently and spoke to his mother, and even his mother said he's boring. So that kind of could tell you what you're getting if mom is going on the record saying, yeah, he's pretty boring. I mean, that's definitely the impression I got from the podium, but you don't know if it's different kind of behind closed doors. But again, if mom's saying that, I think it's fair to say that's not an act. He's very dry. He's a really nice, pleasant guy. You know, I've spoken to him and stuff, and it's not like he's, standoffish, but he is definitely – he spent a brief time in New England. Maybe some of the Belichick media relations rubbed off on him. He's buttoned up. And I don't think you're ever going to get big press conferences or even just behind closed doors. I mean, I don't think he's a guy who's going to be flipping tables at halftime and stuff. He's much more of a cerebral type guy. But again, kind of going back to the point, so many different ways to be effective in that role. There's guys who have his type of personality, who have had success. I don't think that is a prerequisite, but definitely the reason why I'm interested to see how this pans out for him. I would not think he would be a guy who would go into the interview room and just blow some owner away. Like, he just does not have a really big personality. And for a guy like him who doesn't have this, long track record, I would think he would need to win somebody over in an interview room. So, I mean, he's already got a second interview with Houston, I think, already on the docket. So he's obviously done well. But that is the one thing I was a little curious how that would go, because he definitely is not a big personality.
I didn't realize he's a Chicago guy. He went to one of my rival high schools. That explains.
And went to Northwestern.
Yeah, St. Rita guy. So that explains the dryness for sure. But here's my question, Dan, about Mike Kafka. Here in Indianapolis, when Frank Reich was the head coach and when Marcus Brady was the offensive coordinator, all play calling went to Reich, and really the offense was formulated by Frank, and Marcus Brady was kind of just there as the system guy and more so a glorified quarterbacks coach. So with Brian Daboll, and you mentioned the offensive mind that he was in Buffalo, then going over to New York, how much of the offense was ran by Kafka, if any, and what really was his role in New York offensively?
Yeah, it's a good question. So, I mean, the bones of the offense is definitely more Daboll than anything else. I mean, he came in, brought his quarterback coach, brought his O-line coach. So, like, they were running, basically based on what they did in Buffalo. But it wasn't an accident that they tapped into an assistant from the Andy Reid tree, and definitely, it'd be crazy not to infuse some of the ideas there. So they definitely melded it together. So I think, when you ask them questions, is this more like the Chiefs or the Bills? They'd give, kind of a stock answer. It's the Giants offense, which, these coaches are good at those types of little expressions and whatnot. But so they definitely melded it, but I would say more Daboll. But then as far as once it became the play caller on game day, as we got into the season, Kafka was calling the plays. Like, Daboll very much wanted to be the CEO over on the whole operation. He did not want to have his nose buried in the play sheet. So he turned that over to Kafka. Now, I'm sure he was very involved in the week, leading up to the game, the game planning, how they're going to attack the opponent. But on game day, he basically, obviously he's given input, but you can't give too much input in 40 seconds. Kafka's making those calls. So he was the play caller. Like, it wasn't one of these situations where he was just kind of a OC in title only. Like, he was the OC, but certainly Daboll had a heavy influence on how the offense operated.
Yeah, it hasn't been a big body of work, but I've been impressed with it. And as you mentioned, the opportunity to work with Andy Reid, I mean, he works closely with Mahomes. That's a pretty good opportunity, and it's nice to have that on the resume, even though just 1 year as coordinator. Not sure I'd invest my franchise there, but still, it's a good place to look, that's for sure, 35-year-old Mike Kafka. All right, let's turn to the other side of the ball for the Giants. Wink Martindale, the Giants' defensive coordinator, also interviewed with the Colts, 59 years old, kind of a lifer as a defensive guy. He's been a coordinator at Baltimore, Denver, now the Giants. How about his perspective or his chances as a head coach from your perspective?
Yeah, well, I mean, definitely a very different personality. Like, Wink is very much more loose and comfortable in his own skin. He'll come in if he gets the job. He'll have people cracking up during the opening presser. Like, he has a great personality. You know, he left Baltimore on kind of weird terms because he was there for like 10 years. He was a DC for the last four, had top five scoring defenses in three of his four years. But in the last year, things kind of went haywire. Him and Harbaugh sort of came to a mutual decision to part ways. And I think a big part of that was, I think Wink, you know, he's nearing 60. He really, really wants to be a head coach. I think he probably felt like he had capped out in Baltimore. So coming to a big market like New York, getting the opportunity to totally run the defense, because, again, Dable's an offensive guy, I think a lot of that appealed to him. So there's no hiding that he wants to be a head coach, but he just really hasn't gotten a ton of opportunities. The interview for the Giants job in 2020, and before this Indy interview, I think that was the only other head coaching shot that he got. So I think, you know, he knows the clock is ticking. He needs to get an opportunity to kind of strike while the iron's hot. But I think he'd be a really good head coach. I think he has this sort of outlaw image and stuff, but when you actually talk to him and talk to his players, he's way more cerebral than he comes across. Like, his game plans were very flexible. I mean, he definitely has a DNA of being pressure, 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 but he's adaptable, and I think players love him. Like, players really rally around him and will play for him. So if you're talking of those two guys who I'd be more excited as a fan, like, I think Wink would generate more excitement, but that's not to slight Kaepernick, because I think he's a really smart football mind. I just have no idea how he'd be as a leader, whereas I think Wink definitely has the leadership down. The question with him would be, like, what would he do on offense? Because he is strictly a defensive guy in his background.
We're visiting with Dan Duggan, the Giants beat reporter for The Athletic, The Mower Shop, and themowershop.com, bringing this interview to you. And we appreciate Dan taking some time. Would the Giants most be hurt by losing Kafka or Martindale?
Yeah, and again, this isn't the slight Kafka. It would definitely be Wink, just because, you know, again, Dable is an offensive guy. He has a lot of hands in there. And Wink runs such a unique scheme. It's not something you could just find someone to plug in and run what he runs. So if they were to lose him, it would sort of be kind of back to the drawing board. You have to, like, figure out what your defensive identity is going to be. You can't just ask somebody else to run what he did, I don't think. Whereas with Kafka, again, he had a big influence here, but I just think the blow would be cushioned a little bit by the fact that, you know, Dable could step in a little more if need be. Again, whoever comes in would sort of be running his offense, and now they, you know, they have the Kafka element. So I think just based on the head coaching background, it's pretty easily that Dable would be, I mean, sorry, that Wink would be the bigger loss for the staff.
Dan, this is probably more so a training camp question, but when you're around the players and you get a sense of their interactions with both of these guys, Kafka and Martindale, did you have an understanding that most, if not all, on the Giants roster respected these guys, number one, and then also enjoyed playing for them?
Yeah, and I think that's both of them. Like I said, they have very different personalities, but they both, in their own way, connect with players. Never heard any grumbling in the locker room or anything like that. I think they're both the, you know, good guys, so to speak, and players rally around them. I just think that Wink's had just a little bit – he's more charisma. Like, there's no way to, you know, two ways to put it. So I think players – really rallied around him. And you, like, defensive players, like, swore by him. You know, they'd run through a brick wall for him, that type of thing. Kafka just, you know, he's really smart, does a really good job, but I don't think he just engenders those types of feelings in his players, because, again, he's just more of an understated guy.
Good stuff. Good insight there into the Giants situation and how that impacts the Colts and their coaching search. Dan Duggett, the Giants beat writer from The Athletic, thanks for taking the time, Dan. We appreciate you.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Dan.
Whether it's audiobooks or all-time greatest hits, long live listening to your favorites. Learn more about Kisqali Ribociclib 200 milligrams at KISQALI.com and talk to your doctor to see if Kisqali is right for you.
The television play-by-play voice of the Indiana Pacers, Chris Denari, is our guest here at the top of the hour from the hotline, brought to you by The Mower Shop and Fishers and themowershop.com. Chris, it's great to have you as always. No Tyrese Halliburton again tonight, but reports that I'm reading are Rick Carlisle pretty happy with at least the non-contact progression for Halliburton getting back on the floor. So all in all, Chris, that's pretty good news.
Yeah, I think that's the best news. And the best news was a little over a week ago, or, you know, when he went down in New York, you're thinking the worst. And then the next day it came out that they hoped he would be back, you know, hopefully by the 1st of February. And it looks, you know, like he's progressing pretty well. The good news is you've got a game tonight. Then we go to Orlando tomorrow. And then you've got Milwaukee on Friday and at Memphis on Sunday. And then you don't play again until the following Thursday. So for what they're looking at, hopefully that all shakes out, that Tyrese could be back for that first game in February. But we'll just have to wait and see. But the good news is he's progressing very well. And the Pacers need him. I mean, it's not to put it all on one guy, but they're 1-7 without him this year. And the offense, while a lot of people will look at the defense over the road trip, it was really the offense. And Tyrese is such a big player in that and how he orchestrates things. So they've had to do some different things, and they'll have to do some different things tonight against the Bulls.
Hey, Chris, it's Vince. Good to chat with you. How about with Halliburton being out, and I know that that makes a huge difference, but the Suns were without multiple players, the Bucks, the Grizzlies. When a guy goes out, especially at this level, somebody else has got to, I mean, it's the NBA, man. Somebody else has got to step up and make it happen. And if one guy is going to make the difference between you being a team several games over 500 and you being on a seven-game losing streak, then maybe there's a deeper issue. Who has got to step up and get this thing turned around for the Pacers?
Well, I think the one thing is, you know, they've turned it over way too much. I think during the seven-game losing streak, it's like 17 per game. But I think, you know, one of the things that, you know, the advantage that these other teams have, and if you look back at Phoenix, they've won three straight now, but I think they're 4-13 without Devin Booker, who's their all-star. And, you know, they were in the finals a couple of years ago, and in Milwaukee, yeah, they don't have Giannis, but, you know, that's a championship contending team. And so these teams, I don't know if they have a lot more depth. I think the Pacers' depth is pretty good, but it's better experience depth. It's players that have been there and done that deep into the playoffs, and that's something, you know, that the Pacers don't have. They're still trying to figure that out. So, you know, if you look at it, I mean, T.J. McConnell's had a great road trip. I mean, he you know, started the road trip with a career-high 29 off the bench and then goes for a triple-double against Phoenix. I think it's got to be more collective. And they've got to shoot the ball better. I mean, that's one of the things in the previous seven games before the road trip, they were shooting nearly 50% from the field. And if you look at the last seven, they're shooting 42% from the field. And those numbers are going to make it very hard for you to win games. So I would say, Vince, collectively, you know, each guy has to step up and take care of his own business, and I think that would help the team collectively.
Yeah, that old philosophy or the saying, what, next man up? I mean, we hear that a lot, but it really is true, and I think that especially with a young team, it's maybe sometimes hard to find that guy that feels comfortable stepping into that role. The Pacers have, what, seven, by my count, seven key players, 25 or younger, and Miles Turner is 26. I mean,
he's the old man.
Yeah, but the future is so bright. But it just bothers me a little bit that with this opportunity, somebody hasn't seen it as their time to kind of take over and make it happen. Easier said than done, I realize. But it is the NBA, and I would echo your sentiments about T.J. McConnell. I mean, that dude, and he's fun to watch. I mean, I just love the energy that he brings to the table.
Yeah, there's no question. And I think one of the things, I did a little dive into the last seven opponents. Unfortunately, you hit a bunch of opponents that were playing pretty well. Memphis, a long win streak. Denver, a long win streak. I think of the last seven, they've won like, if you look at each one of the opponents' last 10 games, they've won 65% of the games. And so that made it difficult. And then I think, you know, you look at somebody like Andrew Nembhard, who I think is going to be really, really good. I mean, the first pick of the second round. But without Halliburton at times, you put a lot on his plate because now he's got to run the team. You still want him to score, and he's been defending usually the best perimeter player. So those are three things that all of a sudden have landed on his plate, and I think that's a lot to handle. And you know, he was under the weather the last few games of the road trip, didn't practice yesterday. I don't know what his availability will be tonight. So you're right. I think, you know, one of the things that you found through this is I think the team did so well early. They exceeded any of our expectations. They were 23-18 through the first 41 games. So you get a little greedy, right? You think, oh man, you know, let's keep pouring it on. And then you get a little bit of a reality check, especially when you go on the road and you're playing without Halliburton. So, yeah, it's you know, time for some guys tonight back home, you know, just to kick it up a notch and do it against a team that's probably playing as well as they've played this year. It's a team that, to some extent, has underachieved. I mean, they're two games under 500, the Bulls. They've got three All-Stars in Vucevic, DeRozan, and LaVine. So, it'll be a tough task tonight against the Bulls.
Chris, my question on McConnell is the work ethic side of it, because having a guy like that to look up to, I'm sure, for a Nembhard, Mather, and even throw Halliburton in there, and I realize James Johnson has done a lot of work at the end of that bench too, but when McConnell does it on a nightly basis and sort of acts as that spark plug, what does that do in your mind for a young player, a young guard, watching him do that?
Well, I think this team is so close, too, when you look at their camaraderie and the culture that I think they've established with this new group. I mean, they're all in for everyone, but especially they see a guy like TJ who puts in so much work. And, you know, I had a chance on the road trip to talk to Jenny Busick, who works a lot with TJ, and they really broke his shooting motion down and in effect, changed his shot a little bit. Just to give him more confidence in shooting the basketball. And, you know, right now he's a 50-40-90 guy. I mean, he's shooting 50% from the field, 90% at the line, and he's hit 6 of his last 8 from three-point range. So you have to give a lot of credit to a guy like that who's 8 years into his career. He's 30 years old and making adjustments to get better, because a lot of players wouldn't do that from the standpoint that they wouldn't want to change or – you know, do something different than what they've done the first, you know, 6 or 7 years. So, yeah, you have to give him a lot of credit. I mean, he's somebody that you just root for. The fans love him. You know, he usually comes off the bench. He had to start the other night in Phoenix. And I would guess if Nembhard's not available, then you'd see McConnell again in the starting lineup.
Chris, you mentioned Jenny Busick. Who's winning the game of horse amongst the assistants for the Pacers? You got Busick, you got Ron Norrod, Calbert Chaney. I mean, who's top-notch there?
Well, let's see. You got to throw Lloyd Pierce.
Gamer.
He started in the backcourt with Steve Nash in college. Boy, I tell you what, Jenny can shoot it. There's no question about that, but I think if you were to break it all down, and then you had Gennaro Pargo, who's a part of the staff, and you know, he was an NBA player, but I think we all would probably look at Calbert Chaney, right? I mean, one of the great players ever at IU, and what is he, the all-time Big Ten scoring leader? Calbert's 50-plus now, but I see him loaded on a regular basis, so that guy can continue to shoot. So I might have to go with Calvert.
Still got the stroke, huh?
That never leaves you, right? It, you know, your wind and your endurance and your ability to get up and down the floor, but that shooting stroke, it never leaves.
Hey, I want you to kind of take us to the broadcast side a little bit, because I want to get in a little bit to our background. I mean, you and I have known one another, so I think we first met back in the late 80s, right?
It's a long time. Yeah,
we were, right. And I'll just give you this little bit of story here. Show up at, I was working for a radio station in Richmond, Indiana. It was my first job out of college. And we broadcast all of the state championship back then. It was one class system. And you broadcast, and our radio station there in Richmond, whether Richmond was still in it or not, we broadcast all the games throughout the state tournament. You know, and Richmond was in the Indianapolis semi-state, so you'd go to Hinkle and you'd broadcast the semi-state. And that was a time when there would be a row of just radio station after radio station after radio station. And our radio station that year got seated there on Radio Row and about mid-court. And next to me was, I didn't know Chris at the time, but was Chris Denary. And that's how Chris and I first met. And I think your wife was maybe like keeping stats for you, and your dad was working the game with you.
Yeah.
And it was just, you know, two broadcasters happened to be seated next to one another, met one another, and literally 40 years later, almost still friends. So that's pretty cool. I've never forgotten it. One of the things that impressed me is Chris had that big Wabash ring on. Yeah, throwing the bling around just to make sure everybody knew that he had the game. And yeah. Well, give us a little scouting report on your game back in the day, Chris.
Oh, I was a valuable reserve in college. That's what I like to say. I mean, I had a really nice high school career. My last 2 years at Westfield, played for my dad, and then went to Wabash and played all 4 years.
Who was your coach at Wabash?
It was Mac Petty. In fact, in a couple of weeks, we're going to have our reunion of our national championship team. So that'll be good. But yeah, it was a tremendous experience. And for me, also from day one, when I walked on campus, my dad had encouraged me. He said, I think you'd be pretty good at this. You ought to go look at that radio station. And ironically, Vince, and you worked at WNDY, the radio station was WNDY back in 1979 when I got there. Wow. So, I went and went to the table and signed up and said, okay, what do you do? Because, back in 1979, there were no high school radio stations, or you didn't really have those opportunities. So that really was a game changer for me to get that experience from day one. And I became the voice of the football team for 2 years. Couldn't do basketball because I played. It was a great experience. And then, back to those days, those high school days, I was the voice of – I was at UIndy. And I was doing games for Bill Shirk at WXLW, my dad was my analyst. Yep. And I still have some of those cassette tapes. I mean, they're almost 40 years old. But to be able to do that with my dad was really, really special.
Yeah, and loved seeing your dad, even when we weren't just doing games, to just bump into him someplace and talk sports and always a good conversation of basketball. I love coaches anyway, so loved your dad, and that was it's funny. I've never forgotten the sitting there at that game and thinking, man, this guy next to me, he looks like he's pretty switched on. And little did I know he'd become Chris Denary. So now, a longtime television voice and face of the Pacers. How many years has it been now?
17.
17 years.
I was the radio voice of Butler for 17, and then alongside Butler and Pacers, I did the Fever for 18, and this is the 17th as the TV voice of the Pacers on Bally Sports. It's been quite a run.
I've got to believe it was one of the great thrills for you to get back on the road to the games this year, because COVID era, you're broadcasting games from the studio. Here in Indianapolis. And I've been there. I mean, when I was doing the truck series at Fox, we did half the races from the studio, called them from the studio. So I get it. But take us kind of behind the curtain, if you will, as a broadcaster, and what that's like doing that, and the joy of getting back to the game and being there live versus being in the studio.
Life is so much more than a diagnosis. It's about sharing time with those you love, hanging with friends who lift you up, and experiencing all those moments that bring you joy. All hits, no skips. Learn more about Kisqali Ribociclib 200 milligrams at KISQALI.com and talk to your doctor to see if Kisqali is right for you. So long live singing to the oldies, jamming out to something new, and everything in between.
Yeah, I mean, the one thing that I think that, people don't realize is that the ability that you have to make connections with the players and the coaches when you're on the road, because there, there's a lot of downtime. You're on planes, you're on buses, you go to shoot around, those types of things. For instance, we stayed the night on Saturday night after the game in Phoenix, and then on Sunday we flew home, but we had a breakfast for the entire travel party before we got on the buses to go to the airport. And, you're sitting at a table with Coach Carlisle and Ron Norred and players. And those are opportunities that you have to build relationships, because I think when you're the play-by-play voice of a team, and the same would be for Quinn as the analyst and JJ and all of us that travel, I mean, you're that tie to the fans, really, with the players. And there's a trust that you build with the players and the coaches. And I think it's more easily built when you're around. You know, we have the great benefit that we can go to any practice. We can go to any shoot around. There are some teams that broadcasters aren't allowed to do that. And clearly during COVID, you know, the toughest year was that first year where we couldn't go to practice. We couldn't go to shoot around. We couldn't be around the players or the coaches. So everything we were doing was via Zoom. Can you still do it? Sure, you can, but you don't build those relationships. And I think especially when you have a new and a young team, and you've got guys that you haven't worked with before, it really becomes essential that you can be around them and learn about them. So there's no question that, you know, from that standpoint, I think it really helps your broadcast because, you know, I remember I used to tell my dad, this was a number of years ago, Vince, we did a couple of studio games back in the Fever, the time I was doing the Fever. And I remember talking to my dad when he was still alive. He goes, hey, how do you do that? What's it like? I go, Dad, I'm watching the same thing you're watching at your house. I'm just the one talking about it because I'm watching the same monitor and I'm getting the same picture. So when you're in the building, no matter where you are, if you're courtside or if you're up, there's just other things that you see. So those are all the advantages that you have when you're live on site.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the other things, too, is you used to always be courtside. And now I know that some arenas have the broadcast locations up a little bit, especially for the radio guys. I'm not sure if as the TV crew, if you're always courtside. But we see so many more fan seats courtside now than we used to. And then the other night in Los Angeles, you had the incident with Shannon Sharp, who got involved with an argument with the Memphis Grizzlies players, and they had to be separated. And eventually Sharp was escorted from the arena or from the court, took him back behind in the locker room area, and then he was able to come back out later. But are you seeing more interaction, fan? And I got to believe that's a tough position for the players and coaches sometimes when so many more fans are accessible and feel entitled to engage the players and coaches.
Yeah, I think there's pros and cons. I mean, I think it's the great thing about the sport is that you can be so close as a fan that you can really gain an appreciation of how fast, how big, how strong, you know, how quickly the game moves, but they're also, you know, it can create some negatives as well. We're probably of the 30 venues, we're probably half and half from a TV standpoint, probably 15 down and 15 up. In Utah back in November, I was a little bit under the weather, and we were way up. I felt like I was on the moon. I mean, we were so high. I was like, my hearing wasn't great. I mean, I had a lot going on. I'm like, man, I feel like I'm on the moon. But I'd say half of the places it's like we have at Gainbridge Fieldhouse where we're either right next to the bench or we're on the scorer's bench. So like I said, I think that's the beauty about basketball is that fans can be close and they can get a real feel for what's going on. But at times there can be some negatives as well as those players are so close to the fans.
Chris, my broadcast question comes from what just happened the other day on the radio side with Mark Boyle, 3,000 Pacers broadcast. And that was an awesome video that the Pacers put out with Rick Carlisle giving MJB the game ball. You and Mark obviously have worked with the Pacers each for a long time. So what do you think you guys learn from each other most?
Well, there's no question. I learned a lot from him back in my Butler and my Fever days is just listening to Mark. I don't think there is anybody that I've listened to that is as descriptive and paints a picture as Mark. And when you're doing radio, I mean, that's the thing that you want to do is you want to paint the picture so that the listener, wherever they might be in their car, sitting at home, that they can visualize what's going on in a game. So there's no question that back in the day, I used Mark as somebody that I listened to and wanted to improve my radio broadcast game after game. And I think now as you know, colleagues, I do TV, he does radio. I mean, we bounce things off each other. We share information. I mean, I get some stuff during the day that I forward to Pat Boylan and Mark. And so, you know, it's all about making each of our telecasts and broadcasts better. I mean, there are some people that, you know, may start out the game listening on radio because they're out and about and they finish watching on television, or it may work in the opposite way. So it's all about, you know, putting out the best product that we can put out, both radio, television, digital, all those kinds of things. And, you know, there's only a handful of people in sports that have done 3,000 games with one team. So, you know, just a tribute to him after 35 years, what he's been able to accomplish.
And how many of those years have you worked with Quinn?
All 17. All 17 years. When I first started out, I also had Clark Kellogg. He would do about 20 games. And so I would bounce a little back and forth between Quinn and Clark. But yeah, Quinn and I have been together for 17 years.
And now I know this as a broadcaster, when you work with someone, and I've not worked side by side with someone for that long, but your broadcast partner kind of becomes like your traveling spouse in a lot of ways. I mean, you get eventually at some point you get kind of sick of seeing them, or, you know, they rub you the wrong way occasionally. How many times do you or Quinn kind of get in a situation where you have to bite your tongue?
Oh, you know, I'm sure that happens. There's no.
Don't lie to me, Chris. We've known each other too long.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not knocking Quinn or not asking him the same about you. I mean, it's just
me. I may say something that irritates him, or that type of thing. But yeah, I mean, it's one of those situations where the one thing that he coined a few years ago, and I give him credit for it, he goes, "Look, we're an infotainment. You know, we're providing information, but at the same time, we have to entertain." And a case in point, we had a premium ticket event last night, and we were all able to be there with some players and visit with, you know, our fans and our season ticket holders and our sponsors. And I had one guy, you know, he said, "Hey, if we're not at the game, we watch every game with you and Quinn." He goes, "You guys are in our house like four nights a week." Yeah. And that's, you know, when you think about it, that's for about 6 months. That's what we are. Mm. And so we've got to make sure that we have fun and you know, energize people about the team, because it's a long year. And it can't be all just, you know, straightforward facts and numbers and those types of things. So yeah, we have a lot of fun with it and look forward to it each and every night.
Yeah, I think you guys do a great job, and you make it look easy, and I've done it enough to know it's not. And including that back and forth with your partner, and you guys do a good job. Hey, basketball question before we let you go. The Hashimura trade, the Lakers acquired him. I saw that the Pacers were a team that maybe had dipped their toe in the water with Hashimura. They gave the Lakers gave up 3 second-round draft picks, yeah, and Kendrick Nunn doesn't seem like a high price for a guy that was picked 9th in the draft a few years ago. Were you surprised that he went that cheap, and were the Pacers in the mix there?
I'm sure, you know, there's always discussions going on. You never know. You know, I follow it just like the fans. I mean, just try to figure out, you know, what's out there. And this is the time of year. We're a couple of weeks away. Well, really, I guess a little over a week away from the trade deadline, those kinds of things. I've always liked Rui Hachimura at Washington, and it makes a lot of sense for the Lakers. I mean, you know, so much has been made about their two first-round picks in 27 and 29 that I think they really want to hold on to, because they don't know how long. I mean, it's only 2023. You know, how long is LeBron going to play? He's 38 years old. He's still putting up fabulous numbers. But, you know, I'm not sure the Lakers want to mortgage their future in that situation. So that's – I give them a lot of credit. I think that's a pretty good deal. They've got enough – backcourt depth that I think they can do without Kendrick Nunn, but Hashimura gives them somebody that can shoot the three and give them some minutes at the forward position. So that's the first one to fall. That should set in motion, I think, an interesting next 2 weeks to see what happens with, you know, trades and those types of things across the NBA.
Chris Denari, our guest on the hotline, brought to you by The Mower Shop in Fishers and themowershop.com. Last thing from me, Chris, the report I'm reading right now, Daniel Tice not available tonight, of course, but the veteran center is progressing well in practice per ESPN and could be available soon. I know the trade deadline is the trade deadline. We'll have to see what happens with both buy and sell stories. But Tice, you would think he would slot in pretty well on that second unit. I don't know if you've seen him in practice, but if you have, how does he look and how do you think he would be able to gel with that second unit?
Yeah, he's starting to do more. There's no question about that. I mean, he's starting to get more of a run. I mean, he played all summer with the German national team in Eurobasket and then had a procedure to clean up some things in his knee. So he's a guy I've always liked. I mean, when you look at what the Pacers were able to get in the trade for Malcolm Brogdon, Aaron Nesmith has done a really good job, almost a double-figure score. They got the first-round pick from Boston, which will, you know, probably be in the late 20s because of where they are. But, you know, Daniel Tice is a very capable player. I mean, I'm sure Boston was not thrilled to have to, you know, lose him, especially when they had the injury to Robert Williams earlier in the year. But I'm interested to see how he fits in, you know, when he's fully healthy. And it appears that that is sooner rather than later.
You've been around a long time. I mean, and you've seen this situation of guys coming back from injury or guys that are healthy but just don't play that much. And then all of a sudden they get called upon to get in and contribute. And it's hard. I mean, it's hard to just come in after not playing and adjust to the speed, you know, to not have rust. Because when you go in the game, you're not expected to be rusty. And yeah, it's not, you know, we can sit at home and we can criticize or evaluate from our armchair position. But if you've been around long enough, you know that it's hard. I mean, it's hard to come in those situations. And I think we take for granted sometimes that guys in that situation just jump right in. And Duarte, for instance, just jump right in and supposed to be as good as, like, he never missed a beat.
Yeah, the speed of the game, Vince, and you're right. I mean, and that's what, to me, has changed in the last 10 years. I wrote down this note tonight. Don't know if I'll use it. I mean, like you and Brendan and, you know, as play-by-play people, we have all this preparation, and I've got all this preparation on my chart, but I may only use 5 to 10% of it tonight. I may carry over stuff. But one thing I noted, and this tells you about the speed of the game and what you're referring to, like with Daniel Tice, is the Bulls have increased their scoring in 10 straight seasons.
Wow.
But you go back in 2012-13, they averaged 93 points per game. Mm. They're averaging 115 points per game now. So it tells you that in a 10-year period, I mean, they're averaging almost 25 points more per game, which means there's a lot more possessions, right? And to that point, what you're talking about, the speed of the game today is so much faster than it was even 10 years ago. But to your point, I think it can take a while to get adjusted to the speed of the game, because any coach and player will tell you, as much as you practice, as much as you do, it still does not simulate what you're going to face in an NBA game. So that's why you'll see players come back and have a minutes restriction or those types of things, because the game is just so much faster these days.
Well, and guys teams are taking 43-pointers a game.
Right.
I mean, can you believe, right. I mean, it's incredible the number of three-point shots that are going up these days. If you're, you know, old enough to remember, like you said, the years of the Bulls where they were scoring, you know, 98 a game. Hmm. I mean, it was uncommon, you know, then if both teams were over 100 in a lot of ways. But nowadays, man, if you saw an NBA game where both teams scored under 100, you'd be curious as to what happened.
Yeah, I mean, one of the games this year, what was it, Miami and the Pacers, it was 89-82, and I thought, man, we are back in like 2011 or 2012. But think back to some of those playoff games that the Pacers played in the early 2000s.
Oh, yeah.
They were playing games. I remember there was a game against Detroit. It was like 72-67.
Yeah. That's a third quarter score for most games these days.
That's right. That's right.
Hey, you're the best, Chris. I appreciate it. Longtime fan and longtime friend, and certainly glad to have you on with us today. Thanks for your insight, and we'll look forward to seeing the game tonight, Pacers and the Bulls.
Oh, always great to talk to you, Vince, and thanks, Brandon. We'll talk to you guys soon.
Thanks, Chris.
Life is so much more than a diagnosis. It's about sharing time with those you love, hanging with friends who lift you up, and experiencing all those moments that bring you joy. All hits, no skips. Learn more about Kisqali Ribociclib 200 milligrams at KISQALI.com and talk to your doctor to see if Kisqali is right for you. So long live singing to the oldies, jamming out to something new, and everything in between.
Mike Chappell, segueing from Elvis to the king of the Colts, the guy who has covered the Colts for, Mike, has it been like 40 years?
Well, since 84, do the math. Wow. I mean, my Ball State math doesn't work for me all the time, but since 84.
Yeah, I'm a Ball Stater too, so I have to take my shoes off usually when I get above about 10. You know, I'm curious about this, and we had a little bit of this conversation with Denari from as a broadcaster. I'm curious about the media side of, because I don't think people really understand what goes into being a beat reporter. But in that course of time, what's been the biggest change as a reporter in how you cover the team, whether it's access or tools or things you can or can't do or people you can or can't, in regards to how you have covered the team all these years?
Well, I guess you'd say tools and as the internet.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
In the past, you know, what you had as information is what you had, whether it was from agents or players or someone with a team, and that was something that you took time and really worked on. Now, you still do that. I mean, you still do that, but you didn't have 10 different people with blogs who have sources that only they know who the hell they are. And you're flooded with information. You know, brush fires went on since the star that, you know, the sports editor would say, hey, I heard this. I said, well, where'd you hear that? He said, well, I saw it posted. And so you spent so much time chasing things and putting out fires, and maybe 1 out of 10 things were right. So that's what I've always said about the internet is the good and the bad. Is the good is it's immediate. There's an immediate exchange of information and right now. And the bad thing is it happens right now, and it seems like we're not as concerned about accuracy and also accountability. If you're wrong, those people move on to the next topic. So that's the main thing, because you still do your work. You still – I'm sort of past the part where I – text, you know, 20 agents and all that. They wore me down. But that's what you do. You've got your own sources. You trust them, and you honor them. When they tell you something, either on the record, off the record, you trust them, or they no longer work with you. So, but the internet and the immediacy and how things, it's funny, someone who just happens to have a blog, they'll report that, well, you know, we hear the Colts are going to bring back Tony Dungy as a coach, whatever you want to say. And then all it takes is somebody else to say, well, it's been reported that. Yeah. Well, no, it's not been reported. Yeah. It was thrown out there.
Yeah.
So then they take on a life of their own. And that's where people really, really need to be careful about what's been reported and what's been thrown against the wall. And the really good reporters do that. And the lazy ones are the ones that aren't so good. They just take and run with it, and it just mucks up the work. It works.
At what point, and I don't know if there was a particular move or transaction that this changed, but you'll relate to this, of when it changed from being most important to be right to being most important to be first. Right or wrong, be damned. You know,
that's a good question. I don't know. And anyone who says, you know, if I'm first with five things and I had two of them right, that's not, you know, yeah, that'll get you into the Baseball Hall of Fame with your batting average, but that's just not good enough. You just can't be first to be first and you're wrong. It just doesn't work. And if you do it often enough, then, you know, people, you know, establish myself, the guys at the Star and the Athletic and ESPN and all the other, I say reputable, but established media sites, you understand who you can trust and who you can't trust. When I see things, you know, there are certain people I read on the internet, and you can't, you know, I've used sources as well because the guy doesn't want his name used. But when I see some guys use sources, I don't trust them. And a lot of guys I see use sources, I say, you know, this guy's really respected. He does his work, and he doesn't just throw stuff against the wall. So you really have to consider the source of people using sources. But again, it's just too easy now to have a voice, and you have the hot take, you know, that everyone wants to have now. And, you know, if you say that, you know, you put out there that sources tell me the Colts are going to hire Dan Quinn as the head coach, and they're not there yet. Well, then if it happens to be Dan Quinn, say, see, I had it. I had it first. And just because you threw it on the wall, and that's my problem. Yeah. And it's easy to do that, and you never hear that guy say when he was wrong for the 10th time. Oh, I missed that one.
Yeah.
So that's the biggest problem times. I've got, and it's only going to get worse.
Yeah, times have changed, that's for sure. Last year, the first coaching hire came, I think, what, like the 27th of January, the Bears hiring Eberflus, is that right? So, I mean, where are we? Where are we? Is the Colts hire coming sooner rather than later or not?
I say later rather than sooner. Yeah. Ballard told us mid-February, which I think that is probably a good time frame. They've had, I think they're done with the first round unless they wait for D'Amico Ryans. They can't talk to him until the Niners are done with this weekend's game. And then they're going to pare it down. Maybe they pare it down this week, five, six. You know, to have more than five or six in the second round, to me, doesn't make a lot of sense. I would like to think that by then, after talking to 13 or 14 people, I guess, 13, whatever it is, I would think you'd have a really good idea of who that guy is and how you want to proceed. The one thing that Chris Ballard mentioned last month when we talked to him is you go in with an open mind, because if you go in with a certain type or person that you're looking for, sometimes you miss a really good candidate that just surprised you. So I think they come down to a five or six, you know, second round, and then that's when the owner gets involved.
Oh, go ahead, Mike. I'm sorry.
No, you go ahead.
I was going to say, are all these interviews done in person?
Whether it's audiobooks or all-time greatest hits, long live listening to your favorites. Learn more about Kisqali Ribociclib 200 milligrams at KISQALI.com and talk to your doctor to see if Kisqali is right for you.
Most of these, to my knowledge, have been virtual.
Man, you talk about times have changed, right? I mean, you know, I mean, nowadays we used to think, oh, we couldn't work from home, and now nobody wants to go to the office.
Well, I think you do the
second interview's got to be in person, though, right? If you bring them back for a second.
And that's why it probably the logistics doesn't make much sense to try to bring these guys in, because these guys are also talking to other teams.
Yeah.
Whether it's Callahan or Urban or Dan Quinn or whomever it is. So, yeah, but when you get to the second stage, it needs to be face-to-face. And, again, that's when I think the owner gets involved. And keep in mind that Ballard does all the heavy lifting and the legwork and will have serious input, and then the owner makes the final decision. So, but, yeah, that's why I say it's going to be another, I think, couple of weeks. And if your guy that you want it is a coordinator in the Super Bowl, then you wait.
So this first round of interviews, Mike, if they're being done virtually, who's on? Do you think Irsay is on those Zooms as
I
well?
I think so.
Yeah,
I think I'm sure it's Ballard, and whether he's got a few of his assistants, personnel people, Ed Dodds, whomever, perhaps. And again, they record these, so then I'm sure that they can look back and evaluate, or the owner can kind of see what's going on. But this is, again, and this is, I saw Zach Kiefer wrote that this is the most a team has interviewed candidates in the last 3 or 4 years, which is fine. There's no hurry to do it, as long as the guy that you want doesn't sign somewhere else, and we've not had that yet. It's like everybody's waiting for Sean Payton to pick where he wants to go. But it's I think what's awkward, I think this is the first year where we've had coordinators have talked before the division games.
Yeah.
You know, and boy, can you imagine if you talk to a coordinator and then his team and his side of the ball just stinks.
Mm-hmm.
Stinks.
Yeah.
And they say, well, you know, if you hadn't been so concerned about talking to the Colts, maybe you guys would have done better in your game.
Yeah.
But the flip side is they wanted these guys to have a chance to be, you know, in the thick of the process and not have jobs dry up before they have a chance to really be a candidate. So I see both sides, but it really puts these coordinators in a very awkward position.
If I was a head coach, I wouldn't want my coordinators interviewing for another job until we're done. I mean, it just opens yourself up to too much criticism, and whether it or not it makes a difference or not, it just, the perception of it and what it opens you up to, I wouldn't want that headache.
Even though these guys are very able to time manage and all that stuff, you're right. It's just, that's whatever you do is time away from not what you should be doing. But at the same time, these guys are looking for that first big job, unless you've been a coach before. So you want to give him every chance, but it gives you the opportunity to really mess it up. And then have something slip through the cracks or whatever, or not really be impacted by the interview, but your team plays bad. It just looks bad.
Chip, I know quite the wide net has been cast in this coaching search, and the hot thing now in the league, of course, is to go after the young coordinator or the young guy. But do you get a sense that this team, at least in the spot they're in right now, can really use somebody with some experience?
Yeah, and I've talked to a few people, and they'd like a guy who's been there and done that, even though it's going to be a guy that was fired before, obviously.
Yeah.
But with the idea that they'll have a good opportunity to learn from what they did wrong and build on what they did right. But at the same time, you've got these – let's say they get a Dan Quinn, because he was – with the Falcons for 5 years, I think it was, two playoffs, and then the flame out when he got fired. But if it's a defensive guy, he sure better have a strong offensive staff, like lined up as much as you can, because wherever this team goes moving forward, it'll go as far as the quarterback goes. Whoever they get in the April draft, he's got to be the focal point. So if it's Dan Quinn, who's your coordinator? Who's your quarterback coach? And the problem is you're not going to get Bill or Brian Callahan from Cincy or Steichen from Philly or whatever, because, you know, they got jobs. So that's why I favor an offensive guy, because you know you're getting a guy who's done it, you know, in his specialty, and done it at a high level. The warning I always have for people is keep in mind that Steichen's not bringing Jalen Hurts or A.J. Brown. He's, you know, and Callahan's not bringing Joe Burrow and all his great receivers. So you've got to make sure that you're, as a team, you're convinced that this guy, as great as he's been working in Cincy with that great offense and all those skill players, can do the job with a young quarterback, with a supporting cast you're going to have to build around. But I would still rather have a guy that has shown he can work with a young quarterback, as opposed to a head coach who has a defensive background and, hey, trust me, I'll bring in people to work with the offense. That would make me a little bit nervous. That's why I kind of lean towards a young offensive mind But we'll see kind of what Chris Ballard and how Jim Irsay want to do this.
Yeah, we talked about that a little bit earlier, too. And I think that when you if you do bring in a defensive coach and your offensive coordinator has success, then immediately he's going to be a candidate for the next head coaching vacancy. And then you're starting over again. And if you've got an offensive head coach, you know, he's got his thumbprint on the offense regardless of whether the coordinator stays or goes. So I agree. And especially it's such an offensive league now. If you don't have your offense in tune, you're not going anywhere.
I wrote something earlier in the week about the head coaching search and the quarterback search. And I tell you, somebody can maybe talk me off the island, but to me it is so much more important to get the quarterback right. Mm. Than the head coach. Let's say you bring in a head coach and he just doesn't work. Okay, you fire him and you move on in 2 years. Boy, the quarterback, you're sort of tied to this guy for 4 or 5 years. Not necessarily the guy. If he doesn't work, okay, fine, you get rid of him. But then you're back in searching for the next quarterback, and we've seen how hard it is to get that guy. It's got to be the right time, the right place. You know, you got to be bad and be top of the draft, and every quarterback's there. I just think that getting the quarterback right is so important, and that's why, you know, yes, the coach is important, yes. But, boy, if you get the right coach and the quarterback is Jamarcus Russell, I just don't know where you go as a franchise.
And we had that conversation too, Mike. I think that, you know, it can set you back. I mean, it will set you back. If in 5 years you decide, okay, I'm going to cut bait and get rid of this guy. Okay, now I got to find another quarterback. But you also just wasted a top five pick in the draft when you could have gotten an offensive lineman or an edge rusher or, you know, that number one wide receiver. I mean, it not just hurts you at the quarterback position. It hurts you where you could have also drafted maybe a guy that could be the cornerstone of your offensive line for the next 10 years or whatever the case may be.
And on top of that, the rest of your roster is getting old.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, Jonathan Taylor's 2 or 3 years older and Michael Pittman. So it just – and again, we've seen so much through the years. You get the guy who you think's the guy, and after 3 years you say, well, I really don't know. I mean, they're sort of there in New York with the Giants and Daniel Jones. Yeah. They've had 5 years. And yes, it's you've invested so much time, not so much money the way the structures are now, but everything around him, and then you got to start it over again. And it's just hard. We've seen since Luck retired how hard it is you just don't go out and get a guy. And what's made the Colts situation so worse for the fan base and everybody. As you look around and you see Joe Burrow and Patrick Mahomes and Herbert and Allen.
There have been a few busts in there. There have been a few busts in there, though, too. I mean, the teams are dealing with, right?
But when you get the guy, you know, he can do, like I mentioned, with Luck and Manning, you know, I pointed the game in 2003 when the Colts trailed Tampa 35-14 with 5 minutes to play. And that quarterback, if he's that guy, he gives you a chance to win it. Hmm. Remember, Andrew Luck was down 38-10 in the playoffs. That guy can do that. And if you don't have that guy, you better be darn good. You know, but Brock Purdy, well, yeah, he's getting by because he's got the number one defense in the league, and he's got Christian McCaffrey. You know, so if you don't have that quarterback, you better be awfully good everywhere else.
Yeah, I think Purdy's done a good job of not beating himself. I mean, you had the high price. Dak Prescott throws 2 interceptions. Purdy throws none. And I thought that was really the difference in the game. Do you see, Mike, do you see that guy in the draft at the quarterback position? Because I'm skeptical. I'm skeptical.
I don't think there's another – no one's even actually thinking there's even a Trevor Lawrence.
Yeah.
And he was considered in that Manning, Andrew Luck level. No, I don't. I don't see a Joe Burrow. But you don't have to have it'd be great to have that guy, but you can win at a high level with a really good quarterback, not a great quarterback. And that's what they have to do. They have to get the right guy who is a – legitimate quarterback, a legitimate NFL quarterback who can make the plays. And, hey, if he turns into something more, remember Jalen Hurts was a second-round pick.
Mm-hmm.
So as long as you don't whiff, as long as you got a guy that's legit, can play at a high level, and occasionally make the great plays and win you games, fine. Because I'm one of those that believes this roster isn't as awful as some people think. I think there's good pieces in place if they can get the line to play better or back to their level and all. They've got some good pieces. But until you get that the quarterback, it's just too hard to win without that guy.
And you said you don't see that guy in the quarterback group this year. So do you see any way, shape, or form, and just hypothetically speaking, say the Colts are going to stay at number four and not move, do you see any way at all that they would not take a quarterback at number four?
Well, they'd need to explain what they're doing. Well, we would know because by the draft, if they're sitting there today saying there's not a guy worth it, and we're going to take a pass rusher, a left tackle, we'll know because they will have signed a free agent quarterback.
Yeah. Yeah.
But here we go again. Mm-hmm. Marcus Mariota or Derek Carr or whomever. Okay, trade for Aaron Rodgers. I mean, really. But because you can't wait till the draft to do that. I don't see how they do that. They've tried recycling, and it doesn't work. It worked 1 year with Phillip Rivers. Wasn't great, but was good. I know how badly the owner is committed to drafting and developing and doing it that way. I would be so shocked if come draft time they sit there at four. I don't think they sit there at four. I think they've got to move up to get a quarterback because, you know, three quarterbacks should go to the top three because people below you need quarterbacks, Atlanta, Carolina. But they can't keep doing this. They know they can't keep doing this. So I think they move up to probably to one and get the guy they want. And then if it doesn't work, you say, man, we swung for the fences and it didn't work, but doggone it, at least we tried. I would be beyond shocked if they sat at four and took the best player and he's a tackle or a pass rusher.
Chap, last thing for me, just back to the coaching front. The great unknown in all of this seems to be Jeff Saturday and what they have in mind with him interview-wise. But like, if they choose to pursue that and they bring back Saturday with Ballard at GM, how do they sell that to the fan base?
Oh, they can't. They can't. And again, that's not saying that he may not be. He could be the coach. I've not ruled that out at all. I think when they, if they reveal who their final five or six are, I believe he'll get a second interview. I believe that. I think Jim Irsay truly believes in Jeff Saturday, and he wants to know how he would operate starting from ground zero in February or end of January to where this is his team, his organization. But I for the life of me, I'm a great BSer. I can BS things. I don't know how I could sell that to the fan base. I really don't, because all you can do is sell what you've got. And as much as Jeff might be the answer if he's given the chance to start from scratch, you still have to say, but this is what you did in an awful situation. I mean, it was an awful situation when he came in here. But that's still your resume, and yeah, they made you know, minor improvements in a few places. But I just don't know how they can sit there when the day they announced that and say Jeff's our head coach, and this is why. I mean, I don't know how they would do that, and however they spun it, fan base ain't gonna buy it. And now, if that's important to the owner, then he won't do it. But if the owner really believes that Jeff's the right guy, he's going to go with Jeff Saturday. He will. And then Jeff's staff will really, really be important. Offense, defense, and all that. But I'd hate to have Jim Irsay come to me and say, you know, I'm going to hire Jeff Saturday, and I want you to write the speech on why I can do it. I don't know that I could do that with a straight face. I really don't. And I like Jeff from here to tomorrow, but in this situation, it just doesn't feel right.
Yeah, great drama. It's great drama, and you can't script it. I mean, it's such a hugely important time for this franchise. Yep. Mike, appreciate your insight. You're the absolute best. I'd love to have you on sometime and just talk about what it's like to be. We're up against it here, but just people don't understand the hours and the commitment to be a beat reporter. It's the hardest job in our business, and I don't think there's anybody that's done it better than you. You've been you've been the best. I appreciate you, and
I appreciate you having me. Give me a call sometime. We'll make it work.
Yeah, sounds good. Thank you, Mike.
Thanks, Ed. Be well.
Thanks, Shep.
Mike Chappell and the Mower Shop and themowershop.com.